I am Marvin Landsberg, and this session is called The Book of Proverbs, The Wisdom of Many. And it's the second in the series this week called Seeing Wisdom, Hearing Wisdom, Speaking Wisdom, William Blake and the Bible. And what we're talking about this week is some late 18th century poet, William Blake, and some about the wisdom books of the Bible, particularly his aggressive reading of the wisdom books, his response to them, to see what he was up to and what that might mean for the way we read the Bible. Now, I'd like to begin with a true story. This one comes out of the Army boot camp, where the new recruits were just being gathered and the drill sergeant told them to line up and shout out their last name. So they were doing this, and one guy got to one guy and he shouts out his last name, Florence. And the next guy shouts out his last name. The drill sergeant runs up to him and gets in his face. He says, "What are you, some kind of a joker? I don't have any room for this here." And the guy says, no, that's really my name. And so he says, "Okay, I never want you to stand next to Florence again." And he didn't. And his last name was Nightingale. And that happenstance of putting one thing next to another, one person next to another, one word next to another is really the subject matter for today. Putting one thing next to another and seeing what happens. That was what Blake loved to do, especially with words and with books. So what we're looking at today is to put one of his books, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which I passed around last time, and if anyone wants to take a look at this, and I have some slides also. Blake is asking us to see his book here next to the book of Proverbs in the Bible, to put them next to each other and see what happens. And what happens is always slightly different depending on what page you're on or what part you're looking at. I'd like to start off with a couple words. These are your words for the day, and one of them will be a word familiar to you. I don't know if I have chalk, though.
You want me to go get another?
No, it's the word. If you don't mind fingernail scratching. The word's parable. I mentioned that word Monday. It's a word Blake is interested in. He writes lots of parables. The etymology, the root of that Greek word is intriguing to me. Once I figured out what it meant, and the reason I figured out when I looked was because of what Blake was doing with it. But what parable means is to throw beside, to throw one thing next to another. And you just think about that for a minute. Those words that are appealing to me for a number of reasons. One is the force involved. When you throw something, you're not just tightly setting something next to another, you're pushing it there, and it has the air of randomness about it too. You're throwing it, and if you think of the parables in the Bible, Jesus is making his parables. He's throwing one thing next to another. He's saying the kingdom of God is like, like a mustard seed. And certainly he's asking then his audience to think about that. What does that mean? What does it mean? The kingdom of God is like a mustard seed. How? In what way? And the way I read the parables, especially, thinking about that relationship is always more important than the answer that's given. And lots of times an answer isn't even given. Sometimes it is. Or when another mustard seed one, if you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could move mountains. That's a fascinating one to me too, and I mention that because that's one Blake quotes, and it's one that's really, you could say, the key to much of his thought. it's tied specifically to his use of Proverbs, and that's my foreshadowing of what we'll get to. But if you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could move mountains. Whatever that means, it means Blake has a very specific answer of what that means, and he certainly believes that and takes it out throughout his work. Now, the second word I could get up here is mashal, which is Hebrew for virtually the same thing, although it has slightly different connotations. A mashal in Hebrew means parable. If you're talking about a parable, it's referred to in the Hebrew scriptures as a mashal. Also, interestingly, that's the same word in Hebrew for the word proverb. Proverb, parable, same word used to refer to both things, which we would tend to make a big distinction between. A parable is a story, and a proverb is a short sentence. It might be the moral of a story, but there's a big difference in length, if nothing else. In Hebrew, the same word, mashal, means, or more literally, means to compare one thing to another. That's what parables do, and maybe less obviously, that's what proverbs do as well. Proverbs compare one thing to another. Now, what does a proverb compare? How does that tie into their form? And that's some of what I want to get into a description of. But just looking ahead to what Blake will do with this, he doesn't know Hebrew. Not very many people in England do at his time, after they kicked all the Jews out a couple centuries before. But he was very interested in it. And there were some sort of bad Hebrew dictionaries you could look stuff up in. And Blake was as interested in words as any poet is, always, and as any poet ever was, I think. His method is constantly to take words and to squeeze them and crack them open and to see what's inside. So I don't know this, but I'm sure that word is one he knew, the mashal, because the proverb was one of his key forms, and he's constantly looking at the proverbial wisdom in the Bible and responding to it. And his interest in words isn't just etymological and scholarly, that is to know that that word meant proverb and parable, I think probably would have fascinated him, that you could get narrative and authoritative short statement together in one. But I mean, he has kooky etymologies as well, and puns and all kinds of things that poets do. So when you think of the word mashal, I'm sure the fact that it sounds like mash might have interested him. Now, I mean, that's just sort of a wild guess on my part too, but to mash two things together is certainly what he's constantly doing too. And to mash your thoughts together and cook it up in a mash and to see what happens. So, what I'd like to do, the first part of this then, is to focus on the Bible, the biblical wisdom, particularly the book of Proverbs, and give a quick introduction to biblical wisdom, the wisdom tradition, what's going on in the book of Proverbs, so that when we look at Blake's response, we can look at in some detail at what happens when you set one thing beside another. And just one quick advertisement, if I'll be allowed to do this. This is my book on the subject, where I'm talking about exactly what I'm doing today, or where I look at Blake's works and I set them beside the wisdom books of the Bible. And I mean, something that hasn't been done before. Everybody's recognizing Blake writes a lot of Proverbs and he's interested in the Bible, but I mean, it's here that I sort of argue and show that really what he is consistently doing is producing new versions of biblical wisdom books. So enough of an ad, except if anybody's interested, it's in the bookstore, but it costs too much. So anyway, I'll have some slides today and a few overheads for you to look at, and even a handout. So this is about as multimedia as I ever get. biblical wisdom, when we think of ancient Hebrew or ancient Israelite wisdom tradition, there's two main books that are involved in that, and then some other ones. The book of Proverbs would be the central one, and Ecclesiastes would be the other sort of chief one. And then there's some more wisdom books, which, what would they be? When you think biblical wisdom, anything else come to mind?
Song of Solomon.
Song of Solomon, okay, yeah, exactly. And that would be there. Anything else? Katie found one the other night. Two nights ago, she was reading the Bible in bed, I don't know why, but she started reading a psalm.
Psalm 119.
Yeah, and she quoted Psalm 119 to me, and she said, is there Proverbs in the Psalms? I said, well, in two of them there are, and she just happened to open to Psalm 119 and was reading.
Psalm 1 is basically a Proverbs.
That's right. Those are the two. I mean, Psalm 1 and Psalm 119 are the wisdom tradition Psalms. Mm-hmm. And the book of Job certainly is in the wisdom tradition too. It's full of lots of Proverbs and responses to Proverbs. And then the rest of the things they get included in that. So you've got Book of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Book of Job, Song of Songs, a couple of the Psalms, and then there's Proverbs and folk sayings sprinkled throughout the Old Testament as well. I mean, people quote Proverbs now and then. And a couple of the apocryphal books, Ecclesiasticus or Sirach. I don't know if anybody's read lately. I haven't myself. And the Wisdom of Solomon. Anyway, what I'm talking about today primarily is the book of Proverbs with just a glance at Ecclesiastes, because you really need both of those if you're making generalizations about the wisdom tradition, because they give you two faces of it. But I'll talk more in detail about Ecclesiastes and Blake's response specifically to that book next week. And end of this week, we'll be taking a look at the book of Job, which that's a book that I just am endlessly fascinated by. Anyway, so Book of Proverbs and the wisdom worldview, let me make a few generalizations about that. In fact, I need some Bibles today. I was going to grab some before. There's a few here. Really, it'd be nice if everybody had one.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4.
There are 10 of us.
Yeah.
I made sure I had my Blake on the Bible. That's I'm going to be asking you to do some things and then to do some throwing besides, so you're going to need you to have that open. Anyway, while we're getting together to those, some general characteristics of the wisdom worldview and what wisdom means, and we're making sort of identifying wisdom in the wisdom books. And what that means is, it is really recognized by a particular worldview and a particular way of saying it that's different from the other books of the Bible. Yeah, thanks. So that in the Pentateuch, the long narratives is a type of literary form employed by the Old Testament. The prophecies, telling of the beginnings of the world and of Israel, and there's sort of cultic institutions and a founding figures, lots of stuff. Wisdom is a particular sort of literary genre, you'd say, that's defined by certain characteristics. And some of those characteristics are, and the primary one is that wisdom articulates order. It always presupposes that the world is an orderly place.
Now you're talking Proverbs, you're not talking Blake.
Right. I'm talking about the book of Proverbs now and the biblical wisdom tradition, not about Blake's response. I'll get to Blake's response. We'll peek at that at the end today. So, let me flip this on. So the world, in the wisdom worldview, is an orderly place. It makes sense. It's reassuring. It's conservative. That is, you look around you, God's in charge. And society is an orderly place and things make sense. And the chief aspect, the chief expression of that order is a principle that's repeated over and over in the book of Proverbs. It's referred to by a couple different names. The one I've got up here is the principle of distributive justice. It's also referred to as the principle of retributive justice, except I can't say retributive very well, so that's the term I use. But actually, retributive, retributive, whatever it is. I mean, the root of that word actually is a little bit, perhaps, more enlightening. I mean, what it means is, from the word, the Latin, retribuare, which means to pay, to grant, or to repay. And it's interesting that the concept of profit is very closely tied to the wisdom tradition. When you think of profit, what does it profit if a man gains the world but lose his soul? This constant element of profit, not just material profit, but spiritual profit too. So the law of distributive justice or retributive justice is simply stated that if the world makes sense, if God's in charge, and God is, then someone on earth will reap what he sows. If you sow good, you will receive good back. If you sow evil, you will be rewarded with evil. I mean, it only makes sense that good guys finish first and bad guys finish last.
I get what's coming to you.
That's exactly it.
The way you say it.
So, some examples. Yeah, I mean, you probably think of lots of sayings and proverbs that are expressions of that, just from the folk or popular tradition. There's one version of it in the book of Proverbs. The Lord will not suffer the soul of the righteous to famish, but he casteth away the substance of the wicked. He becometh poor that dealeth with a slack hand, but the hand of the diligent maketh rich. So if you're lazy, you won't earn anything, and if you're not lazy, your crops will grow, is part of that. And then you get the proverb about the busy ant that goes about its business, and leading to Aesop's fables type folk tradition. Now, what I'd like you to do in the book of Proverbs for a second is poke your nose in it somewhere after chapter 9, which is the introductory part where the list of proverbs begin. Just see if you can find some expression of that principle. Just read a few proverbs and see. And if it sounds like more or less some similar version of, if you're good, you'll be rewarded.
Treasures gained by wickedness do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death.
Okay.
Be assured an evil man will not go unpunished, but those who are righteous will be delivered.
Yeah. What are those?
Which verse?
What are the chapters?
Chapter 10.
11:21 is what I heard.
Anybody else have one?
12:2, a good man obtains favor from the Lord, but the man of evil devices he condemns.
Okay.
Go ahead. He who loves pleasure will be a poor man. He who loves the wine and oil will not be rich. The wicked is a ransom for the righteous and the blameless for the upright.
If a man returns evil for good, evil will not depart from his house.
Those are all reassuring statements, certainly.
22, he who has a bountiful eye will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor.
He who winks the eye causes trouble, but he who boldly reproves makes peace.
Interesting. So if you wink your eye,
well, which means kind of don't see what's happening around you.
Yeah. So if someone's doing something wicked and you just
shrug it off.
I can't help it. Whenever I read the book of Proverbs and I'm thinking about what Blake might say, I mean, that's one that he would love
to respond to.
To respond with prophetic condemnation is exactly what he's interested in. And I mean, just to glance ahead of this, meaning, again, what I said on Monday was his whole view of biblical wisdom and the Bible in general, and reading anything was, you have to read aggressively, because if you don't, if you only say the same thing that everyone else has said, it inevitably will become not true, even if it once was true. By repeating something over and over and over again, it becomes a stereotype, conventional, and Blake hated conventional authority of any kind. I mean, and you can think of, I mean, how, I mean, in many senses, I mean, I might agree with that, but certainly not all. But for him, anytime something became true, just because it's been said for a long time, and people hit you over the head with it, it killed modification, innovation. We've all experienced this in our churches, certainly. When we move to the church we go to now, and would make suggestions, we tried that in 1928 once, and it didn't work. And they could quote you the person who tried it, and then the proverbial wisdom that came out of that. And Blake's experience when he was looking around him in society was that happened too often in organized religion, and it was too often how the Bible was used to bonk people over the head with it. And any other quick ones you see in here?
He who sends a message by the hand of a fool cuts off his own feet and drinks violence.
Drinks violence. Which one is that?
It's in chapter 26, paragraph 6, verse 6.
Chapter 22 says, both for one, train up a child in the way he should go, but also, later it says, folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him.
Yeah.
Gee, the rod of discipline.
And that's a kind of an original sin statement, isn't it?
I mean, folly bound up in the heart.
So, man is by nature sinful and unclean, and the way you get rid of that is to bump it out.
Yeah.
Well, you can also take that as, the kid just doesn't think about things. I mean, he just goes ahead and, I've got friends, so I think sometimes just go ahead and do it, and, I think somebody should say, hold it!
Exactly.
You don't do that.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, just when you're thumbing through these, I mean, how do you respond? I mean, is this wisdom that you say, yes, this does make sense, I agree with, or how does this align with the way you or we think today about what is wise?
Well, it always ends up with the problem of why do bad things happen to good people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I mean that when you read this, that's the question. Yeah.
That gets to be the
question. You think yes, but I know.
That's the wisdom tradition. I mean, confronted that problem very early, also, and so I mean part of the wisdom tradition includes some wrestling with that, and that's what Ecclesiastes is. Okay, I know God's out there and rewards the good, but I sure don't see it. And what are we to do about that? I mean, and that's what the book of Ecclesiastes and some of the book of Job is all about, which, I mean, they have their own kind of answers, but especially what those books are wrestling with that problem as much as anything. So, I mean, certainly that's the one response I have to the book of Proverbs, and yet, I mean, to some extent, I mean, it's nice to have articulations of order, and I suppose some of these, I mean, I do the type of translation in my own head, I mean, that those questions force. I mean, what can it mean that the good will be rewarded? Well, someday, is that what it means? Someday, I mean, I hope in a world where God exists that will be the case. I mean, is that the final feast that we're talking about? These things will be true.
And also, someday, I mean, you really can't be a Christian without looking towards the kingdom of God and trying to, Jesus gives instructions to, the kingdom of God is at hand. So, live accordingly, and, you know, maybe it will come to completion soon. Right. So it has to be somewhat relevant.
That idea that our hope is beyond ourselves.
Right.
But then the tension exists between that and being a fatalist, or something like Darwinism, where it's all your reward is, you know, that this life doesn't really matter, that.
Yeah.
And that's the same way, how do you resolve that? How do you have to talk to
people? I read some of these, though, and it gives good instructions to people who are parenting. I mean, some of them are bad. I don't like the rod ones. They're always talking about beating kids. But there are other ones that talk about, you know, basically, if you know, you will reap what you sow. So you know, put a good effort into raising your children, and hopefully things will come out good in the end. I mean, if you just not really care, then you're asking for trouble with what.
Certainly, I mean, it's principles. You have to believe some of this stuff to have an organized society. You have to believe that there's something beyond yourself, that investing in your kids and effort in society will
bring to your society and all that, and being generous. Those are positive things.
Has it always been thus, so that, for instance, in our time, drug dealers can make tremendous amounts of money, and if you're an inner city kid and you see that this doesn't sound like it needs very much, and have there always been people who appear in the short space of time here on earth to reap at least what appears to be good from bad?
No, certainly. I mean, Ecclesiastes starts off saying, I mean, how is it that my neighbor's a bum? And he's rich. Lansford translation of it. But, I mean, and even the book of Proverbs has some imagery for the sinful man, the pit that he digs for himself, he'll fall into, but not everybody seems to, is in the later books.
It is interesting when you talk about, just talk about parenting. Yeah. I think that at certain stages of a child's development, it's good that there are proverbs or very, very regimental, very clear distinctions. This is good, this is bad. And at an early age, a child can't abstract. So you need those proverbs. You need this is the good, this is the bad. And when you're talking about people, drug dealers, there are people who morally, ethically have not come to a point of abstraction. They need to know this is good, this is bad.
Yeah.
This is how the world functions. I mean,
just the mnemonic aspect of Proverbs, too. I mean, there are things you remember that you say. I mean, you talk about kids. I mean, Allison the other day was saying, I think we talked about getting ice cream, so she's saying, you promised, and then a promise is a promise, and it can't be broken. That's a little proverb she's quoting. I have no idea where she heard that, but I mean, that's a piece of wisdom to her that helps make sense of the world for her. So some other characteristics here. Let's see. This gets to some of the forms of proverbs. And just a quick word about language first. The wisdom tradition assumes this strong connection between language and wisdom. So if you'll notice, many of the proverbs are about language, about speaking. I mean, the one you found about reproof is actually quite uncommon. Many of the proverbs say, hold your tongue. I mean, they're thinking lots of people are not wise, so it's better if you don't speak. But there's a strong connection between language and wisdom, so that it's through speaking that wisdom comes into the world. I mean, it's tied to this, the myth, which I want to get to in a minute, take a quick look at sort of the frame for the book of Proverbs. If you think about, sort of, if wisdom is from God, that God comes into the world through language, through speaking, through articulating this wisdom. And then if you think of the gospel books, certainly, the opening of the book of John, the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. I mean, there's this sense that God is the Word, and that Word is wisdom, and in this order is, in some sense, certainly God. So the language then, in Proverbs, has the ability to bring order, but it also has the ability to bring disorder. So bad people talking is a problem, because bad words have force. So there's Proverbs about that. This is 15:1. A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words... And a lot of the ones that I'll be listing, different translations, but a lot of the translations I tend to use are out of King James, because that's the Bible Blake had in his hands. So if you're actually trying to see what he's responding to, that was his words. Another one, legs dangling from the lame, and a proverb in the mouth of fools. And this sets up this sort of association.
Say that again.
Legs, this is 26:7. And this is sort of a literal translation done by James Williams. I don't know, read what that one says in here. This guy goes for the more literal. Legs dangling from the lame, and a proverb in the mouth of fools.
Like a lame man's legs, which ain't useless, is a proverb in the mouth of fools.
Yeah, and so the point is, legs on a lame man don't do any good. A proverb in the mouth of a fool is not going to do any good. Let's see. I want to talk about sex for just a quick minute, and sexual ethics, and then get to the form that's up there. Language is also central to the sexual ethics of Book of Proverbs, and it's real interesting. Chapters 1 through 9 set up this introductory frame for the list of Proverbs that follow. And what it does, it gives you a peek into an ancient mythic tradition that is part of sort of the worldview there. It's not developed in any great detail, but you see glimpses of it in Genesis, certainly, and in other wisdom books. And it sets up the personification of wisdom as a feminine force. And to some extent, being personified as a feminine deity. Can I just turn and take a quick look at this? And the reason this is important, not a lot of it is made in, certainly Hebrew tradition, the mythology isn't very well developed, but Blake is very interested in mythology and picks up on this and becomes a big part of how he will treat and take and make use of wisdom. So you take a look at chapter 8, that's the one specifically. And we know from the beginning that the frame in chapter 1 sets the Book of Proverbs up as this is the wisdom of Solomon. This is Solomon's Proverbs. And that's a later addition, certainly. A lot of the Book of Proverbs, the wisdom, predates Solomon. In fact, a lot of this, some, comes out of the Near East and Eastern wisdom tradition right out of Egypt. You can line up one particular book there and see some of the parallels.
Where does the original concept of seven pillars of wisdom come from?
Good question.
Because they mentioned that in first of chapter 9.
Yeah, you stumped me.
You can think of a Greek temple or something.
Yeah.
So
maybe scholars always do. I just rely on sort of what I read. You can go through this and say, okay, this is old, this is pre-exile, this is post-exile, this is the addition. The early chapters of this are later additions to some of the other chapters. And even this, it's interesting that this chapter 8 wisdom, lady wisdom frame, isn't real early. But take a look at this. This is where, even though it's the wisdom of Solomon, this sets up, these proverbs are the speech of this feminine wisdom principle. This is the speech of lady wisdom, or dame wisdom, as she's referred to in the translations. And you get this moral framework set up in the Book of Proverbs so that Listen to Lady Wisdom, she will bring you health and order. Don't listen to Dame Folly, she will lead you astray from the way. And the constant image for God in the book of Proverbs is the way. And it's the straight path that you need to be on. And that is tied into social organizations. So there's lots of proverbs then about staying with your wife. Don't stray into the hands of the harlot, because as the analog of Dame Folly, she will bring you down. And what you want to do is stay in the arms of your wife of ancient days, because she will keep you healthy. I mean, it's principles of order, if you want an orderly society too, that's what you might expect. But the mythic frame to this that interests me, partly because it interests Blake. I'm on 8:22 on here. And this is where she's speaking. And listen to what this is Lady Wisdom is saying. And again, what exactly is Lady Wisdom? Well, I mean, it's hard to say. You can say this is just an attempt to give a quick personification of wisdom, but again, I mean, there's some sense that this is, I mean, as we think of the Trinity now, I mean, part of what makes God God is this feminine principle in God that will associate gender elements with different aspects, and the wisdom aspect of God is gendered feminine here, which that interests me for lots of reasons anyway. But here's what she says: the Lord created me at the beginning of his work. So it is, she is. She's not an alternative God. They're set up from the beginning. But the Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. So before he created the heavens and the earth, says, well, first thing I'm going to do is create wisdom, Lady Wisdom. Think about this. First thing he does is create a partner for himself, is part of the suggestion of this. Ages ago I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth, where there were no springs abounding with the water. Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before he had made the earth with its fields, or that first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit, so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a master workman. And I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and delighting in the sons of men. So, I mean, That personification of wisdom, I mean, it's here in the book of Proverbs, you find it in some of the other, especially the apocryphal wisdom books, where they develop it even further, which is probably one of the reasons why they're not canonical, because it's, I suppose if this gets developed too far, it poses problems. To have an alternative deity set up as Mrs. God. But, I mean, here, it is this principle, she's wisdom, she's saying these proverbs, and she is the one who calls the people and calls them in, and if you approach her, then things go right. And then the images of Dame Folly, such as in 9:13, if you just take a quick look at that, where she sings parallel songs to these songs of Lady Wisdom. Parallel, but the evil twin version of this. 13 through 18. A foolish woman is noisy, she is wanton and knows no shame. She sits at the door of her house, she takes a seat on the high places of the town, calling to those who pass by who are going straight on their way. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And to him who is without sense, she says, and then here's her song. Stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. So that's bad proverb. That's what Dame Folly will say. Come take secret pleasures in the house of the prostitute. And that leads to death. And it says, but he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are the depths of Sheol. And then you get the list at 10 again. Just to be clear, the Proverbs of Solomon, and then the list of Proverbs. So that's part of the frame that will interest Blake. A couple other things then about the form. I'm always interested in sort of language form here. So jump here. Just look at this. The chief form of Proverbs throughout the wisdom tradition, whether it's Book of Proverbs or any of those, are this binary proverb. And all that means is that in the biblical tradition, once you write down wisdom, it expresses itself with two parts. So there's two verse sets drawn into some sort of parallel relationship. So we'll take a quick look at this in a minute. Here's an example here, 15:1. A soft answer to away wrath, and some kind of punctuation mark to separate the two, but grievous words stir up anger. So there's two parts to this. Now, for a proverb to be a proverb in other traditions, doesn't have to have this two parts to it. But biblical proverbs typically have these two parts. It's called binary proverbs. You can make interesting distinctions between folk proverbs, and then the Book of Proverbs actually has lots of folk wisdom brought into it that tends to be the more pithy type statements. But what happens is proverbs are mini poems then. I mean, there's a real sort of art form into bringing these two sentences into relationship with each other. And for those who read Hebrew, which I don't, I mean, that there's a real sort of poetic attempt to work on word relationships so that it sounds nice when you read it. When we read it, they get stretched out in a more sentence-long version than they actually are in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, there's not very many verbs. In fact, it's interesting when you read the King James Version of this, when they were adding extra words, I mean, the translations, those are the words that are in italics often, and they it's printed with these italic words. There are versions that Blake was actually reading, and he was interested in the words that were italicized also, because that's part of what he was reading between the lines and adding some things. Anyway, take a quick look and just find a couple of quick examples of a binary proverb in virtually anywhere you point, there'll be one. But let's just hear a couple so you can get the sense of the two parts of this. Again, this will be important for what Blake will do to it, because he's interested, his have two parts, although he'll never copy anything, so he'll give it a unique twist. But the way he'll read the Book of Proverbs often is to say, hey, I like half that proverb. I don't like the other half. Yeah.
I was just going to say, chapter 11, verse 2 is, when pride comes, then comes disgrace.
Yeah.
But with the humble is wisdom.
Yeah.
Number 14, wisdom builds her house, but folly with her own hands tears it down.
Yeah, the English key to the two parts is the conjunction, but. Anything else there?
The 11:26, the people curse him who holds back grain, but a blessing is on the head of him who sells it. Is that about sharing? It's not about selling and getting money.
Hoarding.
Oh, hoarding, yeah.
Anybody else have one?
13:20, he who walks with wise men becomes wise, but the companion of fools will suffer.
Okay, so all those are using the contrast but, aren't they? Not all of them do, but that's the most common.
This is a curious one, though. What is it? 13:22. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the sinner's wealth is laid up for the righteous. I don't know what that means. The sinner's wealth is laid up for the righteous.
It's taken away from him, I think, is the implication.
Laid up.
For the people that are good, not for kids.
Oh, so
his children. His kids won't benefit from his evil. So there's a number of relationships that the Bible uses between these two versets that comprises part of the poetry. I've got them listed here. I don't know how interesting this is to you, so if you can tell me if it's not, we'll move on. But three basic relationships. One is equivalence or elaboration. So the second verset simply repeats or explains in more detail what the first one says. The first verset says something, the second one says, repeats it in another way, or gives it, just says it again to make sure you get it. Here's an example. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whoever is deceived thereby is not wise. So, I mean, it's this repetition format. Second is the ones we've been reading, and the most common is antithesis. Two versets are at odds with each other, so that's where you get the buts. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. So you get one line saying one thing, which is often folly, and then compared with or contrasted with wisdom. And the third one, and this is the one used probably least frequently, but there's big clumps of them throughout, is the riddle proverb. And that's, an interest in riddles goes way back in the tradition and are associated with proverbs from way back. That proverbs as mashals are referred to as dark sayings. This is interesting. I mean, dark sayings mean they're not immediately comprehensible. So you have to think about them. Back where I started, if proverbs are putting one thing beside another, I mean, one of the things they're putting beside another is two statements that are asking you to think about them. The riddle sets beside each other two statements. One sets up the darkest of sayings, which you're not supposed to get, that you're supposed to think about and say, what does that mean? And then the second verset explains it. And the key here is that most, virtually all the biblical proverbs do explain. They don't leave the riddles unanswered. And that's something that Blake will pick up on. And as you might guess, he likes unanswered riddles. He doesn't want you answering every riddle and telling us the same answer every time. And that's where you get some of the real interesting comparisons. But here's a couple riddles. Scoop this up. The name of the Lord is a strong tower. So it gives you an image. So think about that for a minute. And then it gives you an explanation. The righteous runneth into it and is safe. So you hear that. The name of the Lord is a strong tower. Like, well, why? What's the comparison? Well, here's one. Because righteous runneth into it. There's lots of other riddles. Most of them clumped near the back. And I'll have more to say about them later, but I do want to get on to Blake. The last thing on there is this, one of the linguistic definitions then, and some of those characteristics, descriptive characteristics of wisdom, but one way to linguistically define what a proverb is in any tradition is to identify them as an affirmative utterance. And it's jargon term, but I think it's useful. I mean, what they do, the way they function, the way a proverb gets meaning, isn't from the individual will of a speaker saying something, but especially in the book of Proverbs, they derive their authority and force through tradition and summarizing collective experience. So they affirm this tradition, this history, this experience in the past. So that then when you get proverbs of individual experience, like are started to be articulated in Job, although Job and Ecclesiastes mostly question the book of Proverbs wisdom, and it's something else, and that's something else that Blake will pick up on because he wants to write, as you saw on Monday, those of you who are here, he is writing these new proverbs, so what are they? They're not affirmative utterances because they're not affirming this tradition exactly. And we need a new term for what exactly they are. Again, that's my foreshadowing. That term is what I want to talk about Friday, or whenever I go next, I can't remember. And I mean, that term is tied up into what I was saying at the beginning about faith, the size of a mustard seed that can move mountains. So, let me pass out one thing. What have I got? About 7 minutes. Here is a list of Blake's proverbs from his response to Book of Proverbs, The Marriage, Heaven, and Hell. And I need my slides for this. They're going to be small because I have to be close for this overhead. So, as I've been saying, his response to the Book of Proverbs, this is what I argue, is this. It's the Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And in the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, this is a book with a lot of parables and proverbs sprinkled throughout. He's got a list of 70 different proverbs. And he identifies them as the Proverbs of Hell, that's what he calls them. Which by that he means, in this world that he sets up in this book, that religious wisdom is the wisdom of the wrong God. So he's going to give you infernal wisdom, which means this is the real stuff. And by that he means this is the real stuff that's really in the Bible, but you just have to read it the correct way and not let yourself be guided by bad theology or institutionalized sort of readings of things. So he has this list of 70, which is on a couple different plates. They're just in a long list. I just typed them up because they're easier to see in this list. But just, I'll show you a couple slides today. I mean, part of what he's reacting to it is then representations of wisdom. And this is a painting of wisdom from 15th century, where wisdom is a young boy. And it's interesting, in the iconography, fairly quickly, wisdom becomes a male, not female. So that this lady wisdom aspect isn't one of those carried forward very much. And that would make sense. I mean, sort of wisdom gets associated even in the Book of Proverbs. You see it with the sayings of the men, of the elders, in spite of that mythic frame. So here, I mean, the iconography is interesting. A long tablet, a long scroll, a long book, and then reading a book. I mean, that's what it's done with wisdom. It gets written down in books so it can be communicated. In Blake's view, it gets written down in books, and then once it's there, it's no good anymore. Here's Blake's, one of Blake's, that's too small to see, depiction of wisdom. This is an illustration to Dante's Paradise Lost, and this is from the Paradise section when Beatrice, who is Dante's flame thing that he's sort of devoted to in the court of love tradition, she's the one that's the mediator between God and humanity. So she is this wisdom figure dispensing wisdom. And you can see all those little eyes back there. And those are the eyes of God. It's a symbol of wisdom. There's a lot of other weird stuff there. But again, that slide I showed Monday, for those of you who saw it, I mean, that's male wisdom for Blake, too. I mean, there's someone who is God, direct revelation from God, and is hearing the voice. You could say he's hearing the voice of wisdom. And this is from Milton, his illustrations to Milton's Paradise Lost, and Raphael is lecturing to Adam and Eve and telling Adam and Eve about God's plans and the way of the world. So Raphael is a male wisdom figure. This is Bronzino, it's a 17th century picture of folly. So in the iconography, if wisdom becomes male, folly stays female constantly. And in here, there's a couple of interesting parts to that. She's got an apple, so she's Eve. She's the fallen Eve is the part of that. For Blake, he's got fallen women, but typically he doesn't present women as his image of fallen wisdom. That, this is from the book that I'll talk more about on Saturday. But at the top, there's a naked woman getting munched on by an eagle, which, I mean, that's the speaker, the wisdom speaker of many of his books. This woman, who is wisdom, but that's how she's treated in this world. She's abused, she's seen as folly, even though she's not. And I mean, it's got other mythic connections too, but that's just one I had, so. Anyway, that gets us to the marriage of heaven and hell, which again, there's a title plate from. Let me just flip through it. Here's what the thing looks like. So you get a feeling for what this thing is in front of you. That's how it starts. It's got an argument, a weird fragment of a myth, some philosophy, some pictures, some text, stories there. And then you can see up there on the left, it says Proverbs of Hell. And then it's got a list. I mean, this is the last few of them on your list, and then a few more pictures. So if that list that I'm particularly interested in, and what I do in my book, and what I want to do in more detail on, when is it? What day is today? So I do go on Friday. What I want to do on Friday is pair these with some specific proverbs in the book of Proverbs that, I mean, I line up that where I'm throwing one beside another. I mean, Blake doesn't say, look, this one is that one. But and sometimes it's fairly obvious which ones he has in mind. Is to see, what is it that he wants us to be thinking about? How does he want us to be reading the book of Proverbs? But with the time we've got left today, what I'd like you to do is just look through these, this list in front of you, and just see if you see any here that seem to be responding in some way to the book of Proverbs that we were just looking at and talking about some of our characteristics. Do you see any that seem to be a response in terms of form or content?
I guess 51 is the only one that I see that comes across.
To being the similar, you mean?
Yeah, to a proverb. Some of these I don't understand at all.
Yeah. So the thankful receiver bears upon the heart. I mean, that sounds like the principle of distributive justice, mm-hmm. doesn't it? I mean, actually, Blake doesn't like the principle of distributive justice very much. I mean, he doesn't like it as an external law. If you're good, with good being defined by the elders and the priests who are in control of things, then you have to live up to what they say is good, and if you're a little bit kooky or different, you'll get thrown in some pit someplace. And that's a definition of oppression, you know. And he doesn't like it very much.
Number 40 is kind of interesting. The fox provides for himself,
yeah.
But God provides for the lion.
Yeah.
So instead of saying, you know, God provides for the lion, and God, you won't make it, he's sort of saying, you know,
you can maybe not depend on God and still
be okay.
Interesting. I mean, that's...
Or the sly. You know,
if
he means anything more about
what
fox means.
Right. I mean, you could read that way. The fox is cunning and provides himself. Cunning in a bad way. And God provides for the lion.
The wrath of the lion is the wisdom of God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a response to that. I mean, he doesn't like that proverb either. He wouldn't expect him to. If you fear God, I mean, that's what the beginning of Proverbs says. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence. And we've got Blake's response to that one here when he says, prudence is a rich, ugly, old maid courted by incapacity. So you want to know what prudence is? There it is. The only people that are prudent are people who can't do anything anyway. And he doesn't like fearing God. And just to refer back, I mean, one of Blake's central myths, again, is at the fall, when Adam and Eve ate the apple, the world turns upside down. And it's useful for me to just constantly keep that in mind, because what that means then is if we're all walking around upside down, what we think of as up is really down. And anybody who tries to institutionalize that God in a theology is institutionalizing oppression and Satanism. So what you really need to do is turn the world right side up again and realize where God really is, and then you can have true wisdom.